Next, James Fleming edits the week's news on Voices and Events, the program that covers the world to bring the actual sounds and voices in the news. Tonight, the front line in Korea, the debate in Washington, and a sound fantasy of Radio Moscow. Here is the history of the past 7 days as recorded by the NBC newsroom. Now, the editor of Voices and Events, James Fleming.
In Korea, this was another week of preparation for things to come. At week's end, the enemy had thrown down a massive smokescreen to hide his buildup for a possible second spring offensive. UN forces prepared to meet this next assault, and reinforcements marched to the front lines, some of them singing as they went. These are two platoons of Greek soldiers. No cadence count here. They marched to an ancient military song of their homeland. As we listened, we judged that their morale must be good. And all was not quiet on the fighting front itself. Our patrols were busy probing enemy lines, and our artillery blasted some targets.
Fire forth.
All the way.
The men of this battery are from Arkansas, for this is a war where the men of the Mediterranean and the Mississippi fight together. When NBC's John Rich asked the Greek soldiers how they liked Korea, he got a shrug for an answer. But when he asked Arkansas, well...
Well, what do you think of Korea? I'll go back to Arkansas. This is the Long Tom, isn't it?
This is 155 Long Tom self-propelled.
It's a wicked-looking weapon. How far will it fire?
Well, approximately 15 miles.
And you're digging in a new position here, getting ready to hold.
We're getting ready, trying to hold this line up here, I think. Hope we do. I'm getting tired of this chasing back every day.
How fast will this gun move when you get it out on the road?
5 miles an hour.
Well, maximum speed on it is about from 22 to 30 miles an hour. We have some that'll make around 30 and some won't do quite that much.
A pretty comfortable ride, is it?
Well, it's not bad. It's a lot better than riding a truck or a Jeep.
As John Rich roamed Korea this week, he stopped by at the port of Incheon, where some GI tankers had just arrived from the line. These men were trying to catch up on the news, and reporter Rich caught up on some of their opinions.
You know what I mean? Any news on the war will soon be over.
What do you fellas think? You were up in the line.
I
don't think it's
y'all know more than we do. All we is up there fighting like everything.
What are you fellas doing down here at Incheon?
Picking up some tanks. We turned in some tanks for replacement, so we're getting some back. Yes, sir. Right off the line to pick up the tanks. You won't get the poop you have. Let the people know what you think about it right up in your mouth.
The one thing, I want to go home.
Now!
What's that? Wait, pardon me, but I'm for starting an all-out war, going to get this over with, or give up this place over here one. That's me. That's at one's opinion.
I feel the same way about it. Either start it all out or just move on out of here.
A fortnight ago, the Reds were stopped short of the South Korean capital of Seoul, a ruined and deserted city. Such public buildings as remain standing are guarded by ROK troops. We listen now to a scene at what was once the Waldorf of Seoul, the Chosun Hotel, a lonely way stop now on the road to battle.
We're now standing at the front desk of the Chosun Hotel. There's no desk clerk here, no register. In fact, the hotel is completely deserted. The sound you hear, the music in the background, is a Korean policeman playing the piano in a room down the hall.
Thank you.
He's sitting here with his back toward me, playing with one hand, wearing GI clothes, a helmet liner with a white border around it, and a towel wrapped around his neck. The policeman tells me his buddy here is a very good singer, and I think they're going to sing a song for us.
Oh, ye a cha, pennore borumya hon, olmya hejin ye sarai, taushi kuri wo.
Very good. That was Sergeant Shin Q Cho.
And with John Rich, we leave the Chosen Hotel in Seoul. Go south now of this deserted city to a bridge on the Han, where the last refugees head south. This was last Monday, but it's a scene that's been played again and again.
I'm standing here now on the north bank of the Han River at Seoul, standing in the midst of a group of refugees lined up by the side of the road, waiting for trucks to come along and take them across the river to Yeongdong Po and on southward. There's a terrific scramble when the trucks come in. They all climb aboard until the truck is just about ready to fall apart. Another truck is just coming in now. Everybody's picking up his bags, getting ready to climb aboard. They've just let down the tailgate. There goes a little child, an old woman with a walking stick, and a baby on her back. Most of these are women and children. Little children bending under huge bundles. And still they come.
The impact of war on the South Korean population has inevitably brought with it domestic political unrest. The rumblings of discontent within President Ri's cabinet erupted this week in what seemed to be a major governmental crisis, with resignations of cabinet ministers and so on. Ri, they claimed, had taken too much power unto himself. There are not enough facts at hand to make a judgment at this distance, but it must be true that any Korean government would have hard going at this stage of the protracted war. Of greatest concern to our own military men is the possible effect of a governmental upheaval on the morale of South Korean troops. With John Rich, we've been roaming the Korean scene from the front to the Han River. Finally now, we go to an American airbase where we get a close-up of the jet war between our own F-86 and the Russian-built MiG. Lieutenant Bland Eggleston of Alhambra, California, shot down 23 Nazi planes in the late unpleasantness, and he's building up another record in Korea.
How about the MiG that you got, Colonel?
He seemed to be pretty much of a hot rock. He really knew how to fly his airplane. And he was in and out of the battle for a period of about 10 minutes. And finally made a mistake. And I shot him up pretty badly. Chased him on down to the deck. And pilot bailed out.
How about some of the others you've gotten? I understand your record right at the moment is 2 shot down, 1 probable, and 4 damaged. Is that right?
That's correct.
How about telling us about some of the other fights you've had?
Well, fights pretty hard to remember sometimes when you're up there about every day. We usually manage to get some sort of a scrap almost every time we go up. But usually they're pretty fast and wind up in a stern chase with the enemy attempting to get back across the river before we can shoot him down. In about most all cases, that's the way it's been. And a couple of times, well, we've got him before... Or I've got them before they got across. And the other times managed to damage them before they can make the river.
What do you think about the Chinese pilots, if they are Chinese?
Well, they run hot and cold. Some of them very good, some of them very poor. Of course, one that gets away is pretty good, but the guy you get is usually a dummy. They seem to be learning a little bit all the time. They're getting better. Their tactics are improving. And they're learning how to fly the airplane pretty well.
You think the MiG is a pretty good plane, do you?
Very good. Second only to the F-86.
Yes, the F-86's had a busy week as the enemy substantially increased his air activity. Here at this base, the jets warm up now for another mission.
They're starting them up all up and down the line here now. These Sabre jets are beautiful planes. They sit when they're on the wheels, they sit high off the ground, swept back tail way up in the air. I've been watching them circling the field here all morning. They're beautiful planes. They look like a, well, like a barn swallow when they turn over on their side and come in for the landing. He's giving us the signal now. He's ready to start her up.
The roar of these powerful motors serves to dramatize a pivotal point in the current debate on our policy in the Orient. These jets cannot, of course, pursue the enemy across the Yalu, nor strike at his bases north of that frontier. To do so, says the administration, would risk all-out war. To do so, says General MacArthur and his supporters, would hurry a final decision in Korea. This was the week in Washington when the administration, through marathon testimony by Secretary of Defense Marshall and through the words of President Truman, stated its side of the case to the public. Senator Russell, chairman of the Senate panel, listening to General Marshall, summarized the first day of his testimony.
General Marshall went in some detail today as to what he says are the three alternative courses open to us in Korea. First, to adopt the MacArthur policy. Second, to carry on the present policies of the defense establishment and of the United Nations organization, or to withdraw from Korea, the latter being the third alternative. The secretary stoutly maintains that the second suggestion, that of carrying on the present policy in Korea, is preferable to either adopting the policies of General MacArthur or withdrawing from Korea.
Secretary Defense Marshall was called back the next day and the next and the next.
General Marshall insisted that the cumulative effect of all of the various statements issued by General MacArthur was to, in effect, constitute a second voice for America in the field of international relations. And he stated that that could cause tremendous confusion and endangered the loss of all of our allies, if indeed not the security of the troops who were in Korea.
Never before had a nation given public expression to all the world, friend and foe alike, of its policies and future plans. Only top secrets were edited out of the week's published testimony. General Marshall's 6 days on the stand constituted a vast exposition of administration thinking.
If we stick to our guns and continue to punish the aggressors, we can end the aggression in Korea and restore peace. We have been urged to take measures which would spread the fighting in the Far East. We've been told that this would bring the Korean conflict to a speedy conclusion, that it would save the lives of our troops. In my judgment, that just isn't true. I have refused to extend the area of the conflict in the Far East under the circumstances which now prevail, and I'm going to tell you exactly why. I've refused first on military grounds. The best military advice I've been able to obtain, the best collective military advice in this country, is that this course of action would not lead to a quick and easy solution of the Korean conflict. On the contrary, it could very well lead to a much bigger and a much longer war. Such a war would not reduce our casualties in the Far East. It would increase them enormously.
President Truman also warned the nation of the danger of losing our allies by acting on our own.
If the United States were to widen the conflict, we might well have to go it alone. If we go it alone in Asia, we may destroy the unity of the free nations against aggression. We cannot go it alone in Asia and go it in company in Europe. The whole idea of going it alone is the opposite of everything we have stood for since World War II. Going it alone in Asia might wreck the United Nations, the North Atlantic Treaty, the whole system of collective security we are helping to set up. That would be a tremendous victory for the Soviet Union. We do not intend to fall into that trap. I do not propose to strip this country of its allies in the face of Soviet danger. The path of collective security is our only sure defense against the dangers that threaten us. It is the path to peace in Korea. It is the path to peace in the whole world.
In the give and take of national debate, the nation could take encouragement in the fact that the area of agreement between General MacArthur and the administration seemed to be growing. Both agreed, for example, on the importance of Formosa in our defense planning. Two, the debate had apparently been a factor in the British decision to cut off war supplies from Red China, particularly rubber. In New York, General MacArthur suggested that his own statements had served to hurry these decisions. And there were many to speak up for the general, including Governor Dewey.
Now, I do not challenge the power or the right of the President of the United States under the Constitution to relieve a military commander. What I do challenge is the wisdom of his dismissal and the shabby manner in which it was done. So, having lost one of the best brains in the service of our country, where are we? At home, we're engaged in the bitterest controversy, the most venomous public dispute that has divided and confused our people in this century. Our relations with our allies are strained. Communist propaganda is having a field day. So, what do we do about it? I suggest that now is the time for the force of public opinion to compel our government to formulate at long last a policy for the whole Far East, a policy that will stop the spread of communism and start turning it back.
Governor Dewey on the bombing of Manchurian bases.
Now it has also been proposed that we bomb Chinese bases in Manchuria and impose a naval blockade against all of Red China. These proposals involve strategic decisions by our government and our allies on the basis of their intelligence reports from all over the world. They also involve technical military considerations, and the military experts are in disagreement. I am not a military expert, and I do not have access to the intelligence reports, so I cannot claim to know all the answers. But I think we must face the fact that if the Korean War continues, the time will come when we can no longer allow a determined enemy to use important bases free of air attack.
Yesterday, General Marshall testified that the administration operates on the possibility that Russia might strike at any time. Earlier in the week, the president warned that atomic bombing of American cities was a possibility for today, not in some distant future. And said the president, perhaps our greatest danger in these critical times is our national tendency to let down.
One of the worst difficulties we have to overcome is the feeling that we can relax because we are not in an all-out war. That's a terrible mistake. We cannot afford to relax. I was talking to the Secretary of the Treasury the other day, or he was talking to me in a cabinet meeting, in which he said that every time it looks as if we're winning either the fight against inflation or the fight against aggression, you can see the country relax. You must meet this situation head on.
Certainly in these days of mass communications, the national issues and debate would seem to be firming up into sharply defined points of view. In the last analysis, John Q. Voter would decide the nation's course, and we were reminded this week that a day of big decision is not many months away. The Republicans chose Chicago for their convention city in 1952, and the Democrats would follow suit. It won't be long before the great debate will move from Washington hearing rooms to national political platforms, and a veteran California campaigner, Republican Governor Earl Warren, might have been thinking of all this when he found himself the final speaker at the National Conference for Civil Defense this week.
It reminds me very much of the time when I first started in politics, started to run for office in my own county. In those days, we used to have neighborhood meetings, about a half a dozen of them an evening. And all the candidates would go together to these meetings. Each would have one or two retainers, and that would just about constitute the crowd. Every candidate, of course, spoke, and in order to be perfectly fair, they always called on the speakers alphabetically. So as Mr. A spoke, he and his retainers would leave, and then Mr. B would do the same thing. And invariably, when they got down to the W's, there was hardly anyone there. One night, there was just one man left when I got up to speak. But I made up my mind that I would speak, and I spoke just as though we had a crowded house. And when I finished, I said to him, "Now, my friend, I want to express my appreciation to you. It's been very kind and generous of you to wait to hear me, and I appreciate it." He said, "Well, you're quite welcome, but I'm not entitled to any consideration because my name begins with Y and I'm the next speaker."
You are listening to Voices and Events, the sound history of the never-ending story that is the news. And again, your editor, James Fleming.
With tonight's broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, we're concluding the present series of Voices and Events programs. For all of us in the newsroom, this has been an extraordinarily interesting and rewarding assignment, and by no means the least rewarding part of this venture has been the keen interest shown by our listeners in NBC's development of these new techniques of reporting. Many of you have asked to hear again some of the actual reports that recorded the sound and fury of these hectic times. Two spots in particular have been requested again and again. So during the remaining few moments, with a bow to our listeners, we'll reprise them. The first is Virginia Hill's testimony before the Kefauver Committee. We doubt there's much social significance here, but we're inclined to agree with our listeners that this was about the most diverting exchange of this spring. Senator Kefauver begins, and Virginia Hill, Mrs. Hauser, that is, takes over. Hollywood has never touched it.
Do you still bet the horse races?
That's the only thing now?
Uh-huh.
I don't bet anything now. I'm afraid I'll win, and then they'll say I made more money than I did.
You mean you just don't want to win anymore?
I don't want any more.
Well, that's a good reformation, all right.
You've testified now about a lot of the details of your own finances and your own business. But are you really not in any position to give this committee any of the details you must have heard about the business of Siegel or Adonis?
But I never knew anything about their business. They didn't tell me about their business. Why would they tell me? I don't care anything about business in the first place.
The reason
I
don't
even understand it.
That you seem to have a great deal of ability to handle financial affairs.
Who, me?
You seem to have taken very good care of your own finances.
I take care of myself, but...
And frankly, it's hard for me to believe, sitting here watching you... the last half
hour. Whether you believe it or not, I didn't know anything about their business. I wasn't interested. And in the first place, if they ever started talking to people, I left because I didn't want to know.
It just seems impossible that
you wouldn't
know
who their associates
were.
Well, maybe it's impossible, but
it's true. You just didn't want to know.
No, I didn't want to know anything about anybody.
Thank you.
Mrs. Hauser, did you go to Italy when you were in Europe?
I was never in Italy in my life. Only Lee Mortimer had me there. With two children that I can't find. I'm supposed to have two grown children. He had me there twice. I've never been to Italy in my life, and I've never met Luciano or seen him or anything.
Well, he had you there, all right.
Well, he had me there twice. He had even a woman that they found and said it was me. He had her picture in the paper with two kids.
But that wasn't you.
Well, it certainly wasn't. I was in Mexico even when I came across the immigration laughs. Says, "You're supposed to be in Italy." I said, "Well, you see where I am." They said, "Well, they got to write about something."
So you didn't know Lucky Luciano?
Well, I never saw the man in my life or been near him or anything. Know nothing about him.
Who do you know in St. Louis, well?
Well, some of the people are not people that you would be interested in, and I wouldn't care to mention.
Well, tell us some of the people we'd be interested in, you know.
Well, I don't think you'd be interested in many of them. Swifty was there when I was there, so I went to see him.
You spent some time at Galveston, too, haven't you?
Galveston? I've never been to Galveston in my life.
All right. Anything else?
Nothing more.
Thank you very much.
Is that all?
That's all. You can go back home.
Well, day by day, we have additional evidence that these Kefauver hearings, despite some of their entertainment values, have had a real effect in prosecution circles. Latest to feel their effects is former New York Water Commissioner James J. Moran, who this week was sentenced to 5 years in jail for perjury. Now for one last Voices and Events encore. This next item was inspired some months ago by an announcement from the Kremlin that Radio Moscow was considering carrying commercial broadcasts, Russian style. We let our fancy roam, and with the aid of performers in New York's Two Guitars nightclub, we tried to imagine just what capitalistic-type programs might sound like from an uninhibited Radio Moscow. It could never happen, of course, but we went ahead and asked these performers if they could give us an idea of Soviet radio gone American. Could you, gentlemen?
Yes, I think it would go something like this.
This is Radio Moscow. AM and FM.
Москва была хороша для тебя, моя душа. Пей ты, Родичка, до дна, Андрюца.
With men who know известия best, it's Pravda 2-1.
Now a special request from Marshal Tito in Yugoslavia. He's asking we play Don't Cry Joe. Ha, that rascal Tito. For him, I am singing.
Люблю тебя безумная, но ты не знаешь про любовь мою. Зачем любить, зачем страдать, for his heart don't belong to daddy. Люблю тебя безумная, но ты не знаешь про любовь мою. Зачем любить, зачем страдать, for his heart don't belong to daddy.
Honest Grisha, the smiling Russian, pays highest prices for used droshkis. Go to his used droshki lot on Upper Gorky Street, out of the high mortality district. It's Honest Grisha, the smiling Russian.
How would you like a 2 weeks vacation in sunny Crimea with all expenses paid?
You should live so long, comrade.
Presenting our news commentator from Radio Moscow, Boris Fulton Jr.
Здравствуйте. This is Boris Fulton Jr. speaking from Moscow. From here, believe me, is no commentary. And that's the bottom of the news, comrades. До свидания.
Have you tried Constantine's caviar? It is good for you. But expensive.
This is concluding the commercial broadcast from Radio Moscow, AM and FM, not television.
But we are inventing it.
Well, the Russians have just celebrated their Radio Week, and we pass on these techniques for their consideration. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is all from Voices and Events at this time. Good night, and thanks for listening.
You have been listening to Voices and Events. James Fleming has been your editor and narrator. With this broadcast, we bring to an end the present series of Voices and Events programs recorded by the NBC News and Special Events Department. This is Robert Warren speaking. Arthur Fiedler conducts the Boston Pops Orchestra tomorrow on NBC.